The Guardian.
Welcome back to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Charles Arthur. On the menu this week...
Best education is quite expensive, so social immobility is the norm, and that's something I would like to change very radically.
Dog breeder, failed insurance salesman, and web entrepreneur Joan Guerra is the man behind a novel twist on the Kickstarter model with studentfunder.com. Jemima Kish meets one to discuss a new dawn for funding university education. And sticking with tech-liberated meritocracy, Jemima meets Gary Swartz, CEO of Odesk, the U.S. online jobs agency that's moving the mountain to Mohammed.
You know, the internet enables us now to bring the work to the worker instead of the worker to the work.
Also, we'll have a roundup of this week's big tech news stories. It's been a week of resignations, with Electronic Arts chief executive John Ricciatello stepping down and Warren East from the UK chipmaker Arm Holdings doing the same. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Every venture on the planet is being funded through some take on the online Kickstarter model, pulling in crowdfunding, turning small amounts of investment into workable capital to create business. The same is about to happen for university funding if Juan Guerra has anything to do with it. Jemima Kish met up with the founder of studentfunding.com to find out more.
I'm with Juan Guerra, who is founder of studentfunder.com. This is an example of a website that covers two of our favourite areas in tech, bootstrapping and crowdfunding. Juan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Now, you have a fantastic story of climbing the ladder with great determination to get onto the higher education course that you wanted to do. So tell us how your story began in Mexico.
Sure. I've been bootstrapping for years now. When I was 19, I was accepted in a German university, but I didn't have enough money to get there. So I started fundraising for my friends and family. And when it looked like I wasn't quite going to make it, I sent an email to everyone I knew saying, hey, I'm selling insurance and dogs. If you need any, let me know because I need the money to go there.
How did insurance and dogs come about? That sounds quite random.
Yeah, I have a pretty random family. My aunt was breeding dogs and she would give me commission. And a friend of mine was selling insurance and I qualified as an agent.
Okay, yeah. So did you get to Germany then?
I did. I didn't sell any insurance or dogs, but people came around to help me. And at the back of that, I was also able to build a network out of which I got mentors and my first job 3 years down the line. And again, you know, that experience was transformative for me. I realized life had given me a chance and not everyone has access to these opportunities, so I decided to do something about it.
It's a really good example of a business, yet again, that's built out of personal need. So after you'd got to Germany, this was a course in international business development, and you were just 19 when you started over there, which is quite an ambitious thing to do, to start out in a completely different country, a very long way away from home. So what did you decide to do with the empowerment that you'd had by being crowdsourced through your family and friends, with no small amount of luck as well?
Yes, it was tough because that was just getting there, and then remaining there was another combination of miracles. But I realized how many people fall through the cracks. They have all this potential and they can contribute so much to society, and through no fault of their own other than, you know, the birth lottery or something, they cannot contribute to their fullest potential. And I thought, hey, this is wasteful, not just to the person, it's wasteful to everyone else. This shouldn't happen. There should be avenues that allow people to thrive and reach their full potential. So after my studies, I wasn't too clear on how I was going to do this, but I felt like I should do something about poverty and people not being able to get on with their dreams. And I started working at SME banking for Citigroup in Mexico City, promoting growth at the bottom of the pyramid. And then I went even further down. I started working in microfinance, which was an amazing job. And then I received a scholarship to do an MBA in the UK. And that became very interesting because it didn't cover the full cost of an MBA, but most of it. And again, I was given a bunch of scholarships, but I was short by 5K. So
what did you do? Where are you going to get £5,000 from?
Well,
no more dogs?
Traditionally, no. I mean, when you're 19, you can still get away with it. But if you've already pulled that off and now you're 25, it's extremely awkward. So I tried, you know, I tried different things. I tried asking for loans, but it was a little bit awkward for everyone. And I applied to different scholarship and loan schemes, but they all fell through, partially because I didn't own any land. So again, you run into an income chicken and egg situation.
Well, I don't think there's very many people in their 20s that do own land.
Exactly.
Really.
So if you can't bank on your mum and dad, your chances are much slimmer, to say the least. So in the end, I was trying to tell my university if they could give me the scholarships as loans with the full amount rather than give me, you know, they were offering me 22 in scholarships or so. I was happy to take 27 as a loan and pay back in full. But they weren't able to do this. So I thought, hey, this doesn't make any sense. And in the end, I was lucky. My employer gave me a bonus and thought, you know, they were very generous. And that tipped the balance.
Yes, you've done quite well on the luck
yes.
side, I think,
absolutely.
Which has definitely helped. But it's a very good example of how we can create our own opportunities to some extent, but most people have a poverty of opportunity. And if you happen to be born in a country where there's free education, and if you happen to be part of a family who's already gone to university, it's far easier for you to find all of these routes kind of accessible. So tell us about the idea for your website and how you, I suppose, help people that have that poverty of opportunity.
Sure. When I saw crowdfunding, I saw an opportunity to use it to help people in my situation because it's really not dissimilar from what I did. And I like the fact that it's a win-win. You receive money, but you give something in return. And that has the added benefit that it creates relationships. So it helps. You can essentially use this to level the social play field. People that don't have access to capital or networks can showcase themselves and show what they're able to do and offer for others. And that can help them build those networks and fund that education that is going to propel them to do great things in the future, and everyone wins.
So there's a clear benefit, obviously, for the person who is able to fulfill their potential through education, but there's also a credibility in being part of the donor system for that.
Yeah, and donors get something in return that can hold emotional or very tangible value. So it's definitely a win-win.
So the concept is studentfunder.com. When did you start, and explain how the website works on a practical level?
Sure. The idea started in Cranfield when I was doing my MBA, but I really started working on this full time after I left my previous job in October. The website, it's very early days. It's been a few months. We're running on an MVP, bootstrapping it all the way, trying to get as much done with as little money as we can, which is also a badge that you want to wear. You want to show that you can do this. So the back end really is just run on Indiegogo, and we are some sort of window that showcases the students. And now the tech really for us is an enabler. Our science and art is herding cats. We look for partners in universities that help us showcase the students to their alumni. We look for partner charities that can contribute, partner businesses that can benefit from relationships with these students. And let's not forget that there are huge skill shortages in this economy that are super detrimental to its growth. And if we can help bridge that gap, for example, between STEM graduates and STEM recruiters, then we're in a really good place where everyone wins.
Are you focusing on UK talent, UK universities and UK students initially?
UK universities, but students from anywhere except in UK universities. They can be UK students or from abroad, and they can be postgrad or undergrad students.
Okay, and just thinking about funding that you've had, have you had any interest or any discussions from anyone from VCs to universities who is interested in backing what you're doing?
Universities are interested in what we're doing. I'm not sure funding would come from them. The VCs were too early stage for that, but I've had a few conversations with a couple of people that are interested in being part of this, and I'm contemplating a crowdfunding campaign. We've actually crowdfunded to launch this venture.
Well, that would make sense.
Yeah. In September, we put up a crowdfunding campaign on BuzzBank. I dressed up in an elephant costume and with a mate of mine, Cameron Wills, a cameraman. We crossed the Alps together. And we made a movie that we offered. So we raised a few thousand pounds. And we're thinking of crowdfunding equity when the moment is right.
So if there is no limit, really, to what can be crowdfunded. What does this say about the era of free education? In the UK, until relatively recently, we could expect to have a free higher education degree until recently that even the tuition for that was covered, let alone sort of living allowances going back sort of 20, 30 years. It seems to me that if you're trying to explain to funders what your personal sort of worth is, that it might be a bit easier to do for something like business, but harder to do for art.
Well, yes and no. I'll give you a story. One of our first students who's been funded is a peace worker. He is studying remotely, and he's based in the east of Congo. He's in the eye of the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's in the eye of the storm right now. And many people want peace in the world. I mean, the Congo has experienced a conflict that has claimed over 6 million lives. So every person has amazing things to bring to the table other than just generating money. And that's why our job is not so easy, because we need to bring a constellation of institutions and individuals that would be interested in supporting different kinds of students in different ways and for different reasons.
It's very interesting that you bring up the developing world, because we have challenges in our education system, but we still have an extremely well-established education system. So are you interested in pursuing this a little bit more in the developing world, specifically Africa, I suppose?
I come from Mexico, which is a middle-income country, but at the risk of exaggeration, the best education is quite expensive. So social immobility is the norm, and that's something I would like to change very radically. Now, I would like a student funder to expand internationally and help people from everywhere get the education that they need to get on with their dreams. But also, the UK is very interesting because it's a country that exports a lot of education to many of these countries. It really educates many of the world's leaders. And with the price of education in the US going the way it's going, and the fact that postgrads in the UK, well, master programs in the UK are shorter than in the US, the relative cost is much lower here. So I see the UK as an educational hub for the world, at least in the next decade. And I would love to be part of the story of the person that brought about peace in the Democratic Republic of Congo, you know, the policymaker that disentangled the oligopolies in Mexico, or the next Richard Branson from Brazil.
Given your level of ambition, which is quite clear to see from what you've already achieved, it wouldn't surprise me. But Juan, thank you very much for joining us in the podcast, and the best of luck with it.
Thank you very much.
Latest tech news, here's Jason Phipps.
The Guardian revealed this week that BlackBerry's new BB10 software has been rejected by the British government as not secure enough for essential work. The news is a blow to hopes that the new operating system, released on the Z10 handset in January, would spark a rapid revival in the company's fortunes after a torrid year of losses. The previous BlackBerry version 7.1 was cleared by the UK's Communications Electronic Security Group, CESG, in December of 2012. But The Guardian understands that tests on BB10 and the BlackBerry Balance software, intended to separate work and personal accounts and prevent any copying of data between them, have shown that it fails the same security requirements. Missing out on government business could cost BlackBerry millions in lost revenues, even if rivals are unable to fill the same security space. The government and the National Health Service are two of its biggest clients in the UK, with tens of thousands of users. And continuing with handset hell, HTC's much-anticipated HTC One smartphone has had its release delayed, reportedly due to problems in sourcing camera components and metal casings for the device. The Wall Street Journal reported that Peter Chow, HTC's chief executive, may come under pressure to resign from his board. The paper claims he suggested he would step down if the new phone is not a success. The delay, which pushes back the release of the phone to the end of March at the earliest in any market and into April for many markets, will put extra pressure on the Taiwanese company. It has slipped down the rankings of smartphone makers since revenues hit a peak in August of 2011. The problem emphasizes the issues facing HTC, which makes phones running Google's Android and Microsoft's Windows Phone software, as it's increasingly squeezed between the two biggest smartphone manufacturers, Samsung, which last week launched its new Galaxy S4, and Apple, which is reckoned to be ramping up production of a successor to its iPhone 5. This week saw two big tech industry-related resignations. Video game giant Electronic Arts has announced that CEO John Ricci Attelio is to resign from the company. In a letter to the chairman of the board, Larry Probst, Ricci Attelio conceded that forthcoming quarterly results are likely to fall short of expectations and that he is, quote, 100% accountable, unquote. The industry veteran will step down on the 30th of March, with Probst appointed as executive chairman until a permanent replacement is found. And in the UK, the chief executive of chip producer Arm Holdings, Warren East, is stepping down after nearly 12 years in the role, making way for another Arm insider as the British electronic chip designer looks to expand globally. East, however, leaves the company in good shape. Buoyant demand for its processor designs used in smartphones and tablets led the Cambridge-based firm's shares to a 12-year high last month. And finally, the web avatar took a leap forward this week.
Until recently, I only had a voice. Now I have a synthesized face too. Last year, I could
be very sad
or be very angry. But this year I
Now that rather familiar sound of a computerized and synthesized voice has a difference, because this voice has a face. The digitized avatar face can emulate the expression of human emotions such as happiness, anger, and fear. And the technology could herald a new way of interacting with your computer or mobile phone. The avatar system called Zoe was developed by Toshiba's Cambridge Research Lab with the University of Cambridge's Department of Engineering, and you can see the video on the Guardian Technology website. The face is actually a synthesized and digitized version of a real person, the Hollyoaks actor Zoe Lister. So well worth a view. To read these stories in full and for the latest tech news day and night, go to guardian.co.uk/technology. Now, in the future, a computer may be able to read the paper for us, but in the meanwhile, why not download for free the Guardian Audio Edition? Great journalism read by real people.
This week on the Guardian Audio Edition. The election of a new pope is God's Olympics, global publicity, weeping crowds, and no meaning. Harlem Shake, an online phenomenon. Could it kill sampling? And we look back at the career of Minette Walters, whose first crime novel, The Ice Room, was published in 1992, and catch up with the latest from Fred Vargas, the ghostwriters of Audebeck. To subscribe for free to the Guardian Audio Edition, go to audible.co.uk/guardian, or find us on SoundCloud, iTunes, and Audioboo. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
Working for Yahoo in the US, it's a fair guess to say that a growing part of your work life will be done remotely, either at home or on the move. This emerging remote workforce has become a key part of online job agencies, such as Elance, Freelancer, and Odesk. Odesk is one of the major players in this market, and Jemima met with Chief Executive Gary Swartz to discuss their site and the economic power of the e-worker.
Welcome to the pod.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So give us an introduction to Odesk. How does it work?
Sure. So Odesk is the world's largest online workplace. What we do is we enable savvy businesses to work with independent contractors via the web on a global scale. So essentially, businesses come to us to hire, to manage, and to pay talent online instead of on-site.
How does that work with the recruitment process, though? Because there's still a very human element to people that you work with. Is it more suited to technical jobs rather than, say, customer management?
Well, a lot of our work is tech in nature. It's really any job that can be done in front of a computer. In regards to the human factor, let me explain the way it works. You as a client can post your job, and you'll get applicants to that job, typically 30 applicants within a day. You can search through that list and sort the candidates and interview them via Skype, just like you would in the real world. Or you can go search our database of more than 3 million contractors and invite the ones with the skills that look like a match for your job. And then, of course, we still recommend that you interview them.
And in the UK, how many clients do you have? What kind of scale have you got to here?
Yeah, so let me tell you about the UK numbers. We have 39,000 clients, more than 39,000 clients. These are people who are looking to get work done, and they can't find or compete for the talent they're looking for locally. On the flip side, we have more than 59,000 contractors in the UK. And just a couple of numbers, more than 76,000 jobs posted in 2012 alone, and almost $20 million of work done by these UK clients. And on the flip side, the UK contractors, 86% of the revenue that they made originated outside of the UK. So these are clients that are looking for work, and they want the domain expertise and the situational fluency of UK workers. So some interesting onshore and offshore trends there.
Do they mostly tend to be SMEs? Because I imagine they'd struggle to hire a bit more than the larger companies that people already know about.
That's true. The pain is more acute for SMEs. They can't find the talent they're looking for. And even if they can find the talent in central London, they can't compete with the likes of Google and Facebook and folks offering these great lunches and yoga and dog sitting and everything else that they do. So the SMEs can't compete for talent.
It's interesting that you mentioned those companies. Are you particularly popular among tech companies and the tech startup scene?
Well, I think we are, and that's because the tech companies are online. They learn about ODES because that's where our business is located. It's online, right? We don't have a physical presence in the UK. So I think the tech businesses are savvy. They're online, but we are spreading beyond that, right? As we approach the chasm, and you know, with more than 560,000 customers globally now, and more than 3 million contractors, we are reaching more mainstream businesses.
Of the global companies then that come to, well, virtually visit the UK through your site to look for the contractors that we have here, what are the real strengths, the skill strengths in the talent pool that we have?
Well, we're seeing high growth in tech categories. We're also seeing high growth in non-tech. Let me give you a statistic and then I'll tell you about the specific skills. In 2007, four categories accounted for 90% of the work on ODESK. By 2012, that was more like 35 categories. So once people try ODESK for tech, they say, well, what else can I do, right? And if you think about a product life cycle, you develop your product, then you QA your product, you test it and make sure it works, then you have to market it and sell it and support it and all of the other things. And so we're really getting pulled into these other categories. And some of the fastest growing categories are things like project management, translation, copywriting, SEO, search engine optimization. So really getting pulled into a lot of different skills.
We've traditionally been quite good at mobile. This has been a real strength in London in particular. Is that a strong category for your contractors here?
It absolutely is. Yeah, as a matter of fact, we were chatting with a mobile developer here who's a recent university graduate. And he said he had no credibility because he hadn't a lot of experience. Yet he was able to get multiple clients and earn a far bigger wage on ODESK because of what he was capable of doing, which was iOS development. So we are seeing very significant growth in mobile.
So it's an interesting way for, not just graduates, but developers to access global demand, I suppose, for their skills. Is a lot of the work short-term or contractual, though, the kind of thing that companies wouldn't recruit a permanent full-time position for?
It is. A lot of companies are looking for, you know, they need talent, but maybe they don't need that talent for too long, right? And they need somebody really good at one thing, and then all of a sudden they need something else. And so it's very much on demand. With that said, the average job is about 5 months on ODESK. So it's mostly based on time, not actually a fixed deliverable. So it's not build me this widget and I'll pay you for that. It's I'm going to pay you by the hour, and then we're going to give you tools to manage and pay for each hour. And then ODESK is going to handle all of the payment and compliance on the back end.
This is a brilliant example of how the internet connects the whole world, really. I mean, it's making a developer pool in India, for example, accessible. How much popularity have you seen with the service in India and perhaps in China and other developing markets?
Well, you're absolutely right. It's a global platform. And as a matter of fact, 80% of the work crosses a border. So it originates either in the U.S., UK, Australia, Canada, and a long tail from there. And it goes to countries like India, Philippines, Bangladesh, Russia, US. UK is actually number 10 for contractors. So we are seeing a very global platform, about 160 countries represented on Odesk. And as you said, you know, the internet enables us now to bring the work to the worker instead of the worker to the work. And it's really exciting to empower businesses now to get access to the best talent globally. And equally as important, to enable workers to have the freedom and the flexibility to work from wherever they are in the world on the jobs of their choosing. And both sides are happy with that.
Does that ever throw up any cultural problems between, I don't know, an Italian company recruiting Indian developers? Or do you find that companies are maybe doing it so they don't have to pay as much?
There are cultural differences. And it's funny because you learn over time. You know, you can see some of the patterns in the marketplace. But it really is a marketplace, and buyer value depends on what the clients want and what the contractors want. So some of our clients say, look, I care about quality, and I only want my time zone, Queen's English, you know, cultural understanding of the way that the UK does business, and I don't want to cross the border. And we really, because we have a marketplace with so much choice, we enable buyers and clients to choose who they want to hire and who they want to work for.
We couldn't have you in the pod without asking about Marissa Mayer and her now infamous memo that was supposed to be top secret to Yahoo employees asking everyone not to work from home anymore. What's your take on this? I mean, clearly Yahoo is a very special case because it's a business that really needs to focus very hard on what it's going to do if it's going to save itself. But do you think she's missing a point here?
I do think she's missing a point. But, you know, you make a good point. I view it as almost like desperate times call for desperate measures. And I think that Yahoo has a management issue. She's got to set a stern policy and have folks abide by that. And then she's going to loosen up over time. Now, with that said, I think she's wrong. I think that, you know, the most innovative companies that we see are moving in the other direction. In order to compete for talent, they're recognizing that talent wants the freedom and the flexibility. And so I think that if she's going to acquire or attract the best talent, they're going to have to move in the other direction. And it really shouldn't be a one-size-fits-all, right? But with that said, they have, she's got a huge set of challenges, and desperate times call for desperate measures.
I think you're absolutely right. It's not one size fits all. It's, recognizing the best tool for the job as ever. Gary, that's been fascinating. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for the opportunity.
That's all we have for you on this week's show. Join us next week. But for me, Charles Arthur, Jemima Kish, and Jason Phipps, goodbye for now.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.